Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy. And your plants do too.
Aw,
I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. On this episode, we have Kim Fox, the current state's attorney of Cook County. Remember that Chicago is in Cook County. We also have a conversation with Reggie Bolden, who is the only black legislator in the Arizona state legislature. And then we have the news with me, Brittany, Sam, and Clint. Now, before we jump into this episode, I want to remind you that you should be chasing the work, that the work should be the guide of everything that you do. One of the best pieces of advice that I ever got was to always focus on purpose over position. And what that has always meant to me is that you do the work and the rest will follow. So focus on your purpose, focus on your passion, do the work, and all the other stuff follows. I've run into so many people who are chasing everything but the work, and it never has the results, the desired results that you want in the long run anyway. Chase the work, purpose over position. Let's go. And now my conversation with Kim Fox, the current state's attorney of Cook County.
Hi, Kim Fox. Thank you for joining us on Pod Save the People.
Hi, DeRay. Thank you for having me.
You are the newly elected state's attorney of Cook County.
That's right. Nine months.
9 months. How's it feel?
It is invigorating and exciting and exhausting all at the same time.
And what is the state's attorney for people that don't know?
So the state's attorney is the chief prosecutor for the county in Chicago. It's Cook County. Chicago makes up half of Cook County. A prosecutor, we have two functions here in Cook County. We are the main or the leader in determining criminal prosecution. So who gets charged with the crime, what they're charged with, how those cases are disposed. But we also represent the county as their lawyer and in all manner of litigation, civil litigation. So we have the largest single site jail in the country here.
Cook County Jail,
which we represent the jail, the sheriff, and the county in litigation that arises from the jails.
And before we start talking more about your current work as state's attorney, how did you get here? I, like many people, probably remember your election as one where so many people came out and so many activists, so many community leaders pushed not only to get rid of your predecessor, but also to proactively fight for you. But how did you become a lawyer? Like, what's the story? How did we get to this point?
It's very circuitous. And I tell people all the time, there seemed to be an inevitability that I'd be in the criminal justice system, probably just not as the prosecutor. So I'm from Chicago. I grew up in the Cabrini-Green housing projects, made famous by good times of the 70s. Child of a single parent. My mother was 18 when she had me. I'm 13 months after my brother. So she was 17 when she had my brother. My father was from the West Side, and his family was very much like, wow, you now have two children. You were supposed to be on your way to college. Go to college. And he did. And my mother stayed behind, dropped out of school when she had me. And so, you know, I grew up with a strong praying grandmother, a fierce, tough mom who, like I said, at 18 had two kids and wasn't really ready to be at home.
And your brother is younger than you.
He's older than me.
He's older than you.
He's 13 months older than me. Okay. And so we had struggles. You know, I lived with my grandmother on and off with my mother, with my mother's sisters, with my cousins. And, you know, we lived in concentrated poverty stacked on top of each other. I was sexually abused as a child. I talk about that fairly frequently because, again, when we look at who's in our justice system, particularly women of color, we have a significant portion of them who have had sexual trauma in their childhoods. And that was me. When we look at both men and women in our system, many of them come from single family homes. Many of them overwhelmingly come from areas of concentrated poverty. And so, like I said, I had a lot of factors that the people that I see in the justice system have. And the difference for me was we were able to move out early out of Cabrini to Lincoln Park, which is one of our more affluent neighborhoods in Chicago. Not because we could afford it, but my mother was like, the schools in Cabrini were horrible. And she knew that the cycle would continue if I stayed. So we moved, couldn't afford it. And I got a quality education where I was able to see a world that was very different from mine.
How did you move if she couldn't afford it? Like, what does that mean?
It means like we are old, you know, Chris Rock skit. Like we'd have an apartment that had a refrigerator and no stove. Or a stove and no refrigerator. I mean, we were nomadic. So between third grade when we left Cabrini and when I graduated from high school, we moved 7 times and in fact was homeless back in my junior year of high school. And so my mother would do enough to get in, you know, be able to make sure that she had enough for a security deposit in that first month's rent, and then we'll take it from there. And so, but also that we could live in this district so that
she
I could
was
go to
make
school.
Sure you had a good school.
She was hustling. Right. She was hustling. I mean, and it was tough. I mean, I appreciate it now. Mm-hmm. At the time, you know, you couldn't really have friends over because right. you didn't have anything. And in the projects, at least you knew what everybody had. You had pretty much what everybody else did. When you move to a more affluent neighborhood and you meet kids who, you know, you like, what is this? I remember the first time I saw a basement. And the basement was bigger than like my whole apartment and it had an arcade machine in there. And I was like, what?
You're like, what is this thing called a basement?
What is this? Why is it bigger than my house? And they're like, we just kick it down here. We just like play ball down here. I'm like, but it's bigger than my house.
Right.
So we just, we were always on the fringe. I tell people we were hanging on by our nails, but also that I could go to that school. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer. My mother and my father fought over child support. And so I'd have to go to court with my mom. And the first time I went, I was scared. And she was trying to soothe me and said, you know, introducing, this is the lawyer, this is the judge. And I was like, well, what does the lawyer do? And she says, they fight for people like me and you. And I remember the judge walking in and everybody had to stand up. And I was like, well, what does he do?
Why do people gotta stand?
And my mother was like, well, you gotta be a lawyer first. And I said, all right, cool. I want to be a lawyer. And she never let me shake that. You know how some people get to be, I want to be a cowboy, I want to be a ballerina, you know, something fanciful. Like once I said lawyer, it was like, don't forget you're going to be a lawyer.
What did she say when you got elected?
So my mom passed away in 2012. And it's really, her death, I think for me, allowed for me to do this. I don't know if she were alive that I would be in this position.
What do you mean?
So a lot of who I am has been based on my mother's struggles. My mother was suffered from depression for many years. My mother smoked weed.
What's her name?
Janelle Wilson. She smoked weed every day. And it wasn't even foreign to me that's what she did. People would come over and be like, what's that smell? And I'm like, incense. She had, you know, bouts of, you know, real manic behavior. And again, you're talking 80s, 90s, where they weren't diagnosing bipolar. My mother just would come in, go to bed, or she would just fly off, right? And, you know, that's how we lost our housing when I was in high school. My mother had a good government job working for the city, and this woman and her got into it. And in the midst of an argument, this woman let a little spittle get out of her mouth. I'm just talking. And that was all she wrote. And my mother was suspended for 30 days without pay. And again, when you just holding on.
30 days is a long time.
It's a long time. It's over. So that's what led to our homelessness. And so my mom, when she got her job for the city, she didn't tell them that she was a high school dropout. She said she had an associate's degree. And so she was always very worried about being exposed, right? Mm-hmm. She was very proud that I went to law school. She was very like, I got to fulfill what all of that was about. But any thoughts of doing anything public, she didn't want that. But I think her life for me is why this job is so important. Why I wanted to be a state's attorney, because the judgments that we make about people in our criminal justice system, kind of the black and whiteness of it, the good versus evil, does not is not what real life looks like. My mother has been arrested before for getting into it because she was had moments on the bus. Somebody mistakenly called her sir, and she was like, "Do I look like a sir?" And then it popped off. And I remember her handing me her bag
when they were
coming. Yeah, I was there. DeRay, I had to.
You're like, oh, man, come on, Mom,
my man. We just trying to go seven blocks. And she handed me her bag, and she was like, "Don't let go of my bag." And I was like, "What's in it?" She's like, "I got some, my stuff is in there." I was like, "Oh, God, this is horrible." So I know, as good as a mom that she was to me, mm-hmm. and all of the struggle that we had, I wouldn't be here but for her. Yep. But the criminal justice system would see her as a criminal. And her dealing with depression and how she dealt with depression, how she moved in the world, how people viewed poor people. My mom exemplified what was possible when you saw the humanity in people. And so the shame that she felt was really the propellant for me to want to be able to be in a system that looked at people for their humanity, and a system that really has the potential to sometimes do more harm than the good that we want to do.
And what is, I'm interested in like what it's like to be on the inside now, right? That like, yeah. I was a teacher and yep. I was most recently the chief of human capital in the school system in Baltimore. And I also was on the outside as an after school provider. And I think about what it was like to actually sit in the office every day. And like, I managed our healthcare program. I managed all of our discipline for all employees, hired every staff member in the districts, set salaries. It was just so different being on the inside that there were these decisions, big and small, that I had no clue somebody had to make, and then I had to make them. I can only imagine what that's like on the scale that is your role. So 3 months into your term, you announced that nonviolent offenders who couldn't make bail of $1,000 or more could be released to deal with their underlying issues like mental illness, drugs, et cetera. How did you get to that decision?
So
can you explain sort of what the decision was?
So Cook County Jail, like I said, is the largest single site jail in the country. At one point back in 2013, we had about 10,500 people in custody on any given day. And we'd been under a federal consent decree for years. In 2013, I worked for the president of the county. I was the chief of staff for our county board president. And we were responsible for the budget for the jail. And you look, we spent about $500 million dealing with corrections in Cook County, just the county, $500 million. And so one of the things we were looking at from a taxpayer standpoint, who's in our jail? What are they there for? And what can we do to get out from under the financial weight that comes from having that many people in custody any given day? And so we started looking, and what you saw was a significant portion of the people who were in our jails were there not because they were a threat to the public, not because they had committed a violent offense, but because they couldn't make bond. And we're talking people who had, our lowest level felony possession of drug cases, who had $20 worth of drugs in their pocket, but $1,000 bond. And they're just sitting and waiting. And by the time they got to their first preliminary hearing, the case is thrown out, but they sat there for 3 weeks. So this was a problem that I had seen up close and worked with stakeholders on even before I took office. And I knew coming in that there was this population that we needed to do something about. And so it just was imperative to me from a prosecutor standpoint to say that I have a moral obligation to make this an issue. Historically, state attorneys, district attorneys stand on the side. The judges ultimately make the decision about what your bail is or who gets bail. We make recommendations. We had abdicated that responsibility and just said, we're not going to say anything. And I felt, as a minister of justice, which is what our mandate is as prosecutors, that I could not in good conscience allow my attorneys to stand in a courtroom where poor people were given bails that we knew they couldn't afford. And so I said, well, let's start with the obvious. The obvious was $1,000. You only need $100 to post. If you don't have $100 to get out of jail, we got a problem here. If you sit here for 2 months, 3 months, we had a guy who was sitting in jail for stealing $300 worth of shoes right?
Which is that like a felony? Is it a felony in Chicago?
In Illinois, yeah, the statutory requirement or statutory amount for a felony is $300.
It's interesting, just to pause for a second, that like when people think about felon,
yeah,
like they think like mass murderer,
right?
Like bomb three buildings and shot up a like a movie theater,
right?
But a felon in
$300. It's a phone. It's a phone. It's a pair of Jordans. It's and that's a retail theft, shoplifting of one item. This guy sat in jail for 3 months, wow, for stealing $300 worth of stuff at a cost to the county of $162 a day. And the question that you ask yourself is for the people who believe, right? There's a belief system about what jails are supposed to do. One, jail is not prison. I would always explain to people, jail is where you go before trial. Prison is where you go to be sentenced. And there's a presumption of innocence that is carried with you until you are found guilty.
Let's start earlier. So yeah. I get arrested.
Yep.
And I get, oh, I only know this because I was just at the Cook County Jail today, but I get arrested and I get taken to a Chicago Public, Chicago Police Department holding like a booking place. Yep. Then I get taken to Cook County Jail. Get processed, yeah, and then I go before a bond judge.
That's correct.
Okay, now take us from there.
So you will have a public defender if you cannot afford one. And most people who come through our jails are indigent and get assigned a public defender. And then the state's attorney is there. We'll look at your charges. We'll get your rap sheet. You know, have you been arrested before? What have you been arrested before for? Have you had warrants? Have you not shown up in court? And then very quickly, there's a hearing. They were averaging about 36 seconds. Where
the hearing is 36 seconds?
36
seconds. Stop it. That is not what justice. Justice don't sound like that's not 30, what justice.
It's impossible. 36 seconds.
That is wild. I didn't know that.
36 seconds. And a judge makes a determination. It should be based on your ability to pay as well as what your rap sheet says. And the judge will give you either an I bond, which means you were released on your own recognizance, or you're given historically was a cash bond or a D bond, where you have to post 10% of the bond that is given to you.
So let me repeat back. So if I get a $1,000 bond, then I have to pay $100 to get out 10% of that.
Correct. And I should be clear. So it's if you needed to post $1,000. So your bond is $10,000 and okay, you need $1,000 to get out.
Okay.
So that's the universe. So now people would need to pay $100. It's anybody that had to pay an actual $1,000,
okay,
or less. And so we looked at that population. Many of those folks were there for drug possession cases, retail theft cases, people who had been criminal trespass, who had been on land that they shouldn't have been, or they'd been harassing folks outside of a convenience store. Like if you looked at that population, what we found was that we had people who had either addiction issues and were doing things to feed that addiction, had mental health issues, and we didn't know what to do with them. And a significant portion of them were homeless. And so we said, some of these folks are never going to be able to afford this money to get out. And are these the people who keep us up at night with worry about our safety, or people who, you know, have annoyed us with their behavior and we just don't know what to do with them? And we felt that that was not the criteria for people to be in jail, exacerbating if you have mental health issues or addiction issues, that was a nice segment to start and see whether or not we could make a difference with the rest of the jail population.
So the change that you made is what?
So what we did was we worked with the sheriff's department. So there's a couple big changes that have happened in Illinois and Cook County in particular. With that $1,000 piece, we met with the sheriff's department and the public defender's office and said, give us a list of the people who've been lingering in jails, who've had bonds of this amount, who it appears that the only reason that they're here is because they can't afford their bonds. So then once we got that list, we vetted it. We went and saw, does this person, is there something we don't know about? Are they a threat? Is there some underlying thing? Once we vetted out that that wasn't the issue, we met with the public defenders and we filed joint motions, went into court and affirmatively said, can you let this person out on their own recognizance?
Got it. And that practice is still happening.
It is still happening. We started that in February, and then we issued a new bond policy internal to our office that said that we would be asking for recognizance bonds on a whole host of different cases, including felonies, where we found that people were there for nonviolent offenses. And our goal was, you know, doing a look back to see who's been lingering there is part of the game. The other part is you got to make sure that you don't have those people there in the first place. And then as a result of our policies there, the chief judge, Timothy Evans, issued a new order for all judges in Cook County that says basically you are not to impose cash bonds that are in amounts that people cannot afford.
Now, given, you know, everybody I talk to is like, the end of cash bail is a priority in Chicago. We're working on it. If it's such a priority and there's no bail bondsman here, there's not like an industry sort of fighting you all to to stop it, then like, why hasn't it happened yet?
I liken it to, we don't have bail bondsmen here, but there's this boogeyman that hangs out there, right? And the boogeyman is, you know, the Willie Horton effect, that there are people who are so afraid that if you aren't holding people, you know, that you let them out and they commit some egregious crime while they're out on bail, that people will be like, well, who was the judge that let them out? Who was the prosecutor who let them out? It is driven not so much around policy. I think we get it, but about this abstract something that will happen. And I think everyone agrees that these are human endeavors, that there will be someone who is out on bond who may do something that is harmful to someone else. And they err on the side of don't let people out so that I don't have to be held responsible for that. And I think that's where it is, not just here in Cook County, but across the country. Is the
what do you
fear.
Say to those people?
I say to those people, we've gotten so much bad criminal justice policy that's been predicated on fear not on data and not on like the realities of our criminal justice system. And the harm has always been far greater than any good that one would suggest that it would have. And we just have to do the right thing. And what we're trying to do in Cook County is be supportive of one another, right? Having the state's attorney's office step into the game, having us say, listen, we have a stake in this. We are asking to let people out. Allows for the public defender to not stand out there alone and saying this is what our clients need. I think it also gives cover to judges to say, okay, we're all in this together. Should something happen, don't do the inevitable. Well, if Fox didn't let this person out, then this other person would be safe. We have to say as a system that these things may happen, but the good outweighs what we know is human behavior.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People is coming.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by Factor. Warmer, sunnier days are calling. Fuel up for them with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. Meet your wellness goals in time for summer thanks to the menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. With 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from each week, you'll always have new flavors to explore. You can crush your wellness goals this May with dietitian approved meals and ingredients that you can trust. Make your day delicious from breakfast to dessert. Stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. Treat yourself to restaurant quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon. Now, let me tell y'all, they sent me the Factor meals and it is absolutely true. 2 minutes, pop it in a microwave, and it literally is restaurant quality food. So far, my favorites are chicken parmesan. I am a chicken parmesan connoisseur. This stuff is good. It has broccoli and tomatoes, and it is creamy and amazing. Mmm, yum. So easy to throw it in the microwave and have a good meal. I'm saving money. I'm not eating out at restaurants so much. It's healthy. Like, I cannot say more about Factor Meals. So if you want to be down with this, head to factormeals.com/PSTP50 and use code PSTP50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. That's code PSTP50 at factormeals.com/PSTP50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
Potsy of the People is brought to you by BetterHelp. Now, whew, y'all, the beginning of this year has just been a lot going on, like from work and family and friends and just, you know, the weather's been awful in New York City and Baltimore. There are a lot of stressors happening, big and small. And when we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/people today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/people. One of the things that I recently learned from visiting Cook County Jail as well is that if you get released on electronic monitoring and don't have a house, or don't have a house that qualifies for electronic monitoring, like public housing, that you just get detained. You like stay in detention. That is so wild.
It is, again, this false, it's this false narrative about us doing what, you know, well, we're doing alternatives to detention, right? The alternative to detention is we'll put a bracelet on you and look at how many orders for bracelets that we have. But if we don't have the ability to use them, and again, we have a homeless population. We have a, like you said, a public housing population. Why are you ordering electronic monitoring? And some of it is a fear, right? So the alternative is that I can't monitor you with the bracelet. Well, then I will just have you home on home confinement. If I can't see where you are, if I can't,
but if
get
you don't
a
have a home to go to, you're back in Cook County Jail.
Correct.
Why do you think bond is such a big deal? Like, why is this taking up so much of the public conversation about criminal justice reform?
I think because there's a couple things that can happen. One, if you have people who are sitting in jail because of their inability to get out, if someone didn't commit a crime, but they just want to go home, right? If your time sitting in jail is longer than what your sentence may have been, you may have an inclination to just say, you know what, I plead guilty so that I can go home. Mm-hmm. Justice is not served by people pleading guilty to crimes that they didn't commit because the conditions under which we've placed them while they're waiting for their moment in court has caused them to do so. And when we think about justice, you know, when you think that these types of decisions and that can determine whether you go home or you whether you walk out or you sit for months to years happen so fast, you know, I think people would be surprised. I was just telling a staffer of mine who had been in bond court over the weekend, and he was saying it moves so fast, and you see these cases, people need to see how judges make those determinations, right? Like, there's a lot of conversation, and rightfully so, on prosecutors and on the defense bar, making sure that we have a strong and vital defense bar. But judges, you know, how are judges making these decisions? You know, what are the levers that they look at? How are these hearings done? Are people having an opportunity to have a fair shake? And I don't think we've gone behind the curtain. I think it's been easy in places where there are bail bondsmen to say, well, it's the bail bonds industry. And it's like, no, there's still the justice system that does what it's supposed to do, that is not necessarily operating, looking at the whole person that comes before them. I mean, we talk about people wearing numbers on their jumpsuits. We talk about file numbers. But these are actual individuals. And I think we haven't done a good enough job as a society, not just people in the criminal justice system, to pay attention to the humanity that's a part of what happens in our justice system.
Now, switching gears a little bit, you also prosecute the police.
We do.
How's that going?
You know, I was sworn in December 1st, and right after January 1st, we had an officer involved shooting, but he was off duty. And what was interesting is historically, this office had waited for the administrative review. It was called IPRA, Independent Police Review Authority. to lead those investigations. And then they would finish and would give the cases to us to determine whether criminal charges would be filed. So sometimes that would take months, if not years, before we got the case. And we didn't work on the investigation. We didn't have anything to do with all of the work that comes into making those determinations and then be told, tell us what to do. What we knew was that that wasn't sufficient, that we needed to do a criminal investigation parallel to the administrative process, because anyone involved in this type of work will tell you the quicker that you get to information, interview witnesses, get out on scenes, the fresher you are to the evidence, the better your cases are. So what we did in January was we put together a team of prosecutors and other law enforcement agencies outside of the Chicago Police Department. This involved a Chicago police officer to help us build a team to investigate this case from the beginning. And in that case, we charged first-degree murder charges within 14 days. Again, I was an off-duty officer. That was January 2nd. We charged that officer. And then a month later, we charged an on-duty Amtrak officer in this particular...
I remember this. This is actually one of the only... It's like one of three or four cases this year when officers actually been charged. Tell us about it.
Yes. So that was a case that we charged. An Amtrak officer working around Union Station, which is in downtown Chicago, had come across a group of people who had been traveling, I think, down south for a funeral, but on their way back to Minnesota, had told them to leave, sees them sometime later, begins to commence a pat down. The victim in this case takes off running as a result of the pat down happening and is running full speed away from the officer. And the officer gets into a crouching stance, gets himself in position and shoots this man in the back. And in that particular case, we charged that case within 9 days. Again, having brought in other investigators outside of the normal channels, devoting our attorneys to those cases immediately so that we can get people in the grand jury very early, lock in evidence and witnesses very early, and make the charges appropriate, which was first degree murder.
What has it been like to be a Black woman in this role? You are the first Black woman?
I am.
In this role?
I am.
How has that been?
You know, so I've been a Black woman my whole life. And
true that. True.
Yeah.
True.
And I tell people all the time, I show up in the fullness of that in this job. And for some, you know, it being a Black woman prosecutor is a novelty. And not but for some, I mean, the data bears that out. You know, less than 1% of elected prosecutors in this country, less than 1% are women of color. And so seeing a woman in this role, I think 80% of elected prosecutors are white men. I think women make up about 5% total, and I'm part of the less than 1%, is a surprise for folks. It's very, they don't know how to handle that. In Illinois, we have 102 elected prosecutors for the various counties. I am the only person of color.
Wow.
I am one of, I want to say there are three of us that are women. And so for the people around you, you know, how do we respond? What does this even look like when you've never had a Black woman boss before? Watching that, you know, but again, this has been a role that I've had as a Black woman in leadership, and watching people figure out how to respond to me is interesting. In this space in particular, when our jail is largely made up of people of color, I want to say it's about 86% of the people at Cook County Jail are African-American Latino. Our juvenile temporary detention center is about 94%. When we look at the victims of violent crime in the city of Chicago, they are disproportionately African-Americans, followed by Latinos. And the system, you know, the system, the people who work in it don't look like the people who come from those neighborhoods. We hired our first ever chief diversity officer in my office, and people were, why are you doing that? You know, what does that mean? Are you suggesting that only people of color can do this work? And, you know, having to explain to folks in the office, you know, that there's our voices need to be represented in the highest levels of decision making.
Now, so you are not yet a year.
9 months.
And you have 3 more to go.
Yes. Thank you.
When we talk in 3 years, what will you want to look back and say, like, I'm really proud that we like did these things, or like that we sort of address these issues head on? What are the things that you want to look back on and be like, wow, we fought the good fight on X or Y or Z?
I think I want the communities that we serve to believe that we have been out here advocating for them, right? And I don't know how you numerically quantify that. I want to be able to say that we talked about the people who are in our system, both as victims and defendants, as people in their humanity, and that our policies were reflective of that, that we don't talk about, you know, crackheads or whomever. We talk about people who struggled with addiction issues, and we recognized that we weren't the place to deal with them. And we created programming to make sure that we had public health issues dealt with in a public health space, not in our justice space. Same thing with mental health issues, that we talk about the effects of trauma on young people and don't systemically just throw out kids who engage in behaviors as a result of their experiences and say that we've just lost them and we're done. And so that means, I hope, that we have really thoughtful, holistic programs around juvenile justice, where we partner with people outside of the justice system, that we have lowered the number of people that we are prosecuting for drug possession because we're dealing more with folks on the outside and dealing with treatment. That we have a jail that is populated not by people who are poor and unable to post bond, but by people who are dangerous to the community and have separated those folks out. I want a system where people aren't afraid to come to us. You know, we talk about the volume of cases that we have. There are probably almost as many cases that aren't called in because people don't trust law enforcement. They don't trust the prosecutor's office, or they had such a terrible experience with us that they'd rather deal with justice on the streets than in the courtrooms. And so I want to be able to look back and have people say that they believe that they were able to get a fair shake in Cook County.
And last question is, there's so many people who are in some stage of losing hope, that they have fought for so long and like the system hasn't changed. They voted, they went to the protest, they went to the meeting, they elected this amazing woman named Kim Fox, that they, and they're like, still, it's just not, it's not it. So what do you say to people who have lost hope, who are losing hope in moments like this, especially with this presidential administration? Like, what do you say to them?
These are dark times. I mean, I don't think we sugarcoat where we are. I don't think that we pretend like, what do you mean? We're stepping 5 steps back right now under this administration. I think you own where we are, but that if we give up hope, then we've totally lost. Like, if we don't have the belief that change is possible, then you're not going to put your whole self into the fight. And I look particularly for Black people. We are a resilient people. We have been through challenges that I can't even imagine. I can't imagine what it was like to endure the indignities of slavery, the indignities of having your children stripped from you, or even when slavery ends and it's like, go forth and get your stuff together and go forth and build a life, except we're going to put all these laws on top of you to make it almost impossible. The endurances of the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. We've come through really dark times before. And I think it's, you know, to be Kendrick Lamar, it's in our DNA to survive, to be able to be resilient. And resiliency is dependent upon hope.
Boom. Well, Kim Fox, thank you for joining us today on Pod Save the People. We consider you a friend of the pod.
Thank you.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
This is BVK for Ocean City Tourism, OCMD streaming audio. On March 11th, 2024, the title of the spot is STSA Leisure Summer. This is a 30-second composite stereo streaming audio mix.
Get away with friends to the laid-back Maryland coast. where you can catch up while casting off, and Hang 10 while hanging out, where a day on board is never boring, and Full Throttle is half the fun, where you can sink a putt, raise a glass, and there's always room for one more round. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
And now the news with me, Brittany Paganet, former member of the Ferguson Commission and appointed by President Obama to the Task Force on 21st Century Policing, Clint Smith III, our resident academic, and Samuel Sinyangwe, our resident data scientist.
It's the news. What's up, y'all? This is Brittany Paganet at Ms. Paggetti on all social media.
And this is Sam Sinyangwe at Sam Sway on Twitter.
What's going on, y'all? This is Clint Smith, Clint Smith III on all social media.
I was like, where is Clint Smith?
I was trying to move past it. It's a new day.
No, Clint, people got to find you. The third, they might type in the and then the number three or something.
People are putting like I on the Clint, then like C-L-I-I-I-N-T.
Clint.
People are real confused. Clint Smith. It's like a celebration.
Clint Smith.
And this is DeRay, DeRay on Twitter. Now, today we're talking about two pieces of news. Both have to deal with this. What's happening with this administration. As you know, Pods of the People tries not to be consumed with this administration just because it is all you hear about ever. But this week, so much awfulness happened that we felt like we had to talk about it. So Brittany's going to lead us into one, and then we'll keep going.
So I want you to close your eyes, unless you're driving. I want you to close your eyes and think back to the news reports you saw coming out of Ferguson in 2014. The images, the tweets, the videos, and I want you to think about how appalled you were to see military equipment on residential streets, streets that I spent a lot of my childhood on, as did many others who were out there with us. Tear gas, armored vehicles, MRAP vehicles, pepper spray, machine guns, officers in full riot gear, armed with bullets and rubber bullets and chemical agents when we were armed with cell phones and signs and our voices. So I want you to remember that moment. I want you to remember how appalled you were. And I want you to remember that one of the primary demands coming out of the movement at that time and continuously has been to demilitarize the police, right? That if we are going to have police in the current format that we have them, at the very least, they should operate as guardians of the community who abide by the Constitution rather than warriors who engage in combat with everyday citizens. That military equipment was made possible by a number of programs, but the most famous one is the 1033 program, which essentially supplies surplus military equipment to local police departments. When it was passed, in theory, it was about protecting us against foreign terrorism, but as we saw in Ferguson, it's being used on American citizens. And so in the task force, we took that very seriously. A lot of us continued to pressure the Obama administration to end the 1033 program. We didn't get a full end, but one of our big wins was that we saw a scale back in that program and in others that provided that military equipment. And there had been a number of departments who were both had become unable to receive that equipment based on abuses in the past and military equipment that had actually been seized, right, and reclaimed and returned from these local jurisdictions. But your friend, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, as Clint likes to remind us his full name is, has decided just this morning on Monday, August, what is it, the 28th, to rescind that progress, to reinstate in full the 1033 program and other programs that provide that military equipment, giving the police full warrant to once again be in combat with us. And I tried to come up with really thoughtful analysis, But it's hard for me because I'm just mad. I know how long those of us in the activist community worked on this specifically. And this is why elections matter. This is why whoever has been out there telling folks that it's only local elections that actually affect people, like, I want to make sure that we dismantle that myth every single chance we have the opportunity to, because this will absolutely affect everyday folks. This will affect people in the activist community. This will affect protesters. This will affect people who came outside their house like they did in Ferguson simply for answers and for justice and were met with tear gas. So, yeah, here we are. Deep sigh.
Wow.
Deep, deep sigh.
So I wanted to add in a little bit about sort of what specific types of military weapons are now going to be allowed to be transferred to police departments, to your police department. Here are the weapons that have been specifically banned that now are allowed to go to local police departments. So tracked armored vehicles, in other words, tanks, so tracks, right? A armored vehicle with tracked wheels. Anything that you see a tank in the battlefield. Weaponized aircraft, vessels, and vehicles of any kind. Weaponized military aircraft. Firearms of 50 caliber or higher. Ammunition of 50 caliber or higher, grenade launchers, bayonets, and camouflage outfits, military outfits. So those had been prohibited. The Obama administration prohibited that. Now they are allowed. So your police department can not only request that, but it only has to pay the shipping fee to receive them. It doesn't have to actually pay for those weapons. In addition, restrictions have been lifted on armored vehicles that have wheels instead of tracks, tactical vehicles, manned aircraft, unmanned aerial vehicles, so drones, as well as riot shields, riot helmets, riot batons, explosives and pyrotechnics like flashbangs, and other weapons. So these are the types of military weapons that your police department now can get almost free of charge, thanks to the Trump administration.
What was the rationale originally when these militarized pieces of equipment were brought into police departments? Like, what was the rationale during the Clinton administration, or what was the rationale generally coming from local law enforcement about why they needed ostensibly these resources?
When we met with people in the Obama White House about this, what they said is that it really ramped up after 9/11, yeah. That was when, yeah, the rules became really lax, because there's this idea that if they're terrorists, then the federal government should at the very least be able to take the surplus and just send it to cities and towns across the country. What was also fascinating about it
is the intention of fighting terrorists?
That was sort of the rationale that, yeah, was used, is that, like, public safety, you know, we got the Department of Homeland Security, all this stuff happened, and this just sort of was like one other thing that happened. I think that what we heard from senior officials too was that nobody was tracking this. So, like, they couldn't, you know, because it was an important win to get the executive order that stopped everything from going to it. But then we were like, well, what about the grenade launchers they have? Right? Who needs a grenade launcher?
Right.
It's like, we should probably recall the grenade launchers, and they don't even know, the Department of Justice and the Pentagon don't know the materials that they even sent. Like, people weren't tracking it back then.
So these were sent out from the federal government to, yes, different municipalities and different police departments, and there was no sort of means for the government to understand or know who had what.
Well, that's what they said, is that they weren't tracking it. What was interesting, when I was in Waller County, Texas, where Sandra Bland got killed, and they have like this huge armored sort of vehicle with like a Batman insignia on it. And the Waller County Jail is like as big as my classroom when I was a teen. You know, it's a tiny, tiny place. It's like, what do you need this armored vehicle? You don't need this. In Waller County, y'all aren't using this for anything.
The other thing that wasn't happening was any kind of disciplinary measure for people who misused these things. Mm. So it was kind of like, you get it, do what you want to do with it. And because the scene in Ferguson was so dramatic, we were able to call attention to it. But there hadn't previously been conversation about how these were being used and if departments that abuse these this equipment should have it removed. Right. Like, people just were not holding anybody accountable. It was like a garage sale.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that piece about 9/11, but it feels really emblematic of the way, in a sort of larger macro phenomenon, the way, like, the politics of fear and hatred are used, yep, in ways that would theoretically serve as the pretense for, you know, for example, this militarization, when people use the politics of fear and hatred instead to enact their own sort of like ideologically divisive commitments to doing certain things. So, you know, when people are scared, lots of things happen in terms of the enacting of public policy that is not at all aligned with something, with an initiative mm-hmm. that would be helpful in preventing whatever the catastrophe was that made people afraid yeah. in the first place. And so it's interesting to think about that, right? I think oftentimes we think about that in a sort of larger international and geopolitical context, right? That 9/11 was used as the pretense mm-hmm. to do enact sort of occupation and warfare across the Middle East. But it's interesting to think about the ways that that event also had very real implications yeah. for the way that those things manifested themselves here at home.
What was fascinating that I learned, especially being a member of the task force, was that it was not just activists and community members that felt like the police needed to be demilitarized. It was the police. So I'm on this task force. It's an 11-person panel. About half of us are coming from the community space. People like myself, Brian Stevenson, Jose Lopez, who's an activist out of New York, other folks. And then these, you know, police officers, somebody from a police union, but all fairly progressive folks who, A, understood the difference between the guardian mentality and the warrior mentality, which was something that we took on head first. But they also recognized how much military equipment actually escalated these situations, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're out there with cell phones and signs and you roll out there with a tank, then like, right. yeah, we're things are going to escalate pretty quickly because right. people are scared. And this intimidation factor is actually just not good policing, right? Even from the police perspective. And so from literally every angle, militarizing our police to this extent makes zero sense. And yet it is what the FOP is fighting for. It's what certain contractors are fighting for, right? Because you have to follow the money. And there is and the optics of law and order are what helped fuel this presidency and helped get this guy into the Oval Office. So, of course, if you need to keep your promises to your folks, and that's one of the promises you're going to keep.
And let me read some of the obsession statements that he delivered today. So one argument that he's using is that this is actually important to disaster relief. So he said equipment like helicopters mm-hmm. and armored vehicles are also vitally important to emergency and disaster response efforts, which is interesting. He also invoked the Orlando nightclub shooting by saying these are the types of helmets and gear that stopped a bullet and saved the life of an officer during the Orlando nightclub shooting. This is the type of equipment officers needed when they pursued and ultimately killed terrorists in San Bernardino. Studies have shown this equipment reduces crime rates, reduces the number of assaults against police officers, and reduces the number of complaints against police officers. And what he says—
Did he cite that those studies? Where are these studies coming from?
He didn't cite the studies. This is just what he said.
I've seen a lot of studies. I've not seen a study that says that.
He says those restrictions went too far. We will not put superficial concerns above public safety. All you need to do is turn on a TV right now to see that for Houstonians, this isn't about appearances. It's about getting the job done and getting everyone to safety. The executive order the president will sign today will ensure that you can get the life-saving gear that you need to do your job and send a strong message that we will not allow criminal activity, violence, and lawlessness to become the new normal. And we will save taxpayer money in the meantime.
You know, what's interesting about this is he can cherry pick those studies. And I haven't, you know, he didn't cite those studies, so it's tough to even verify that. But, you know, for every one study that he could cite, there are a multitude of studies pointing to the role that police militarization has played in making communities feel less safe, in fueling the rise of SWAT raids and deployments, militarized deployments of these vehicles, often to execute drug warrants that result in dozens of people being killed every year. So, you know, he's going to pick a very small sliver of what he can say that might be positive about this and ignore the balance of evidence against this. And I think that's what this administration has done the whole time, is ignore the actual balance of evidence, ignore the science, and just push forward an agenda that is incredibly harmful, particularly to communities of color. I would also say, in terms of, you know, next steps and actions, you know, the federal government right now and the Trump administration is pushing these forward. But in many cases, your city council, your state government can actually step up and prevent these weapons from being transferred to your police department. So in states like Montana, they've signed legislation that prohibits police departments from receiving these types of equipment, and that prohibits the use of federal and state funds to purchase the equipment outside of that 1033 program that gives it to them for free. And so, you know, that's an example of what can be done. We've also seen in San Jose, the police department decided to return one of its tanks back to the federal government, saying that this was not actually helpful to what they wanted to achieve. And so, you know, this is something that's going to have to require a local and state strategy, especially, you know, as we've seen Congress be so gridlocked and so unwilling to check this administration.
And one thing that's interesting that I saw that Sessions said was he talked about how this would, quote, improve the morale of police departments. And that's a really interesting thing to reflect on in a sort of larger reflection upon the role of policing. Like, if you need, or if your morale necessitates like bayonets and grenade launchers and tanks, mm-hmm. like what does that say about contemporary policing? And what does that say about where people's notions of like power and authority are stemming from? And I think that that's something that needs to be unpacked and sort of delved into in a sort of larger macro analysis of what police departments are doing as compared to what they should be doing in our communities.
That was such good analysis because I'm just mad. So that was good.
That's real. Sometimes the best analysis is to just to shout.
We have to be fully human. And today I'm angry. Tomorrow I'll be resourceful. But today I'm just pissed.
It is interesting, too, that the invocation of Houston in this moment, you know, the administration has not made any overt gestures to help out the city of Houston in the middle of a major crisis with the hurricane. And for him to say that he's going to restart the 1033 program mm-hmm. as a way to like it, that this would be the magical thing for Houston is insulting.
It really is. And he is doing that in the midst of talking about this, talking about the wall, in the midst of people being afraid to leave their homes because of their immigrant status and they don't know if they're going to be detained. And we're getting reports that ICE has already started to detain people who have been trying to evacuate in Houston. I mean, it's just really disgusting. And when people need not just a moral leader, but need a leader in a time of disaster, they are not finding it in this White House. And it is becoming more and more impactful and dangerously so to everyday people.
So my piece of news is Trump's decision to pardon Sheriff Joe. I believe his last name's Arpaio. I've heard it pronounced many different ways. And so this is relevant and important because this sheriff has been called the Bull Connor of our generation. He is a man who was convicted essentially of moving forward with a racist policy, despite a federal court determining that policy was racist and needed to stop. So literally, he was convicted of illegally pushing forward with a racist agenda. And I just want to step back when we think about, you know, we talked about police militarization and the broader message that that sends to communities, and that this, the message that this sends specifically to communities of color and to immigrant communities in particular, when this man who, you know, was one of the worst police leaders, period, who 160 people have died in his jails, 39 of whom have been hung or, quote, hung themselves,
wow.
Which sort of boggles the mind. This man got a pardon, and Trump released a statement basically praising his service, mm-hmm. as Trump would call it, and the work that he did in Maricopa County. And so I just want to put that on the table and talk a little bit about, you know, what the message is that this sends to other people who are practicing, you know, whether it's police chiefs, sheriffs, police officers, prison guards, other members of the criminal justice system who may now feel emboldened to move forward with racist and unconstitutional practices, knowing that, you know, the president has their back.
And I just want to go back to that point you just made, Sam, about the amount of prisoners who hung themselves or who took their own lives in Sheriff Joe's jail. I really think it's important for people to understand that, like, while suicide is something that unfortunately happens in many prisons and jails throughout the country and is something that needs to be addressed, the number of people who, or the suicide rate in Sheriff Joe's jails was dramatically higher than any of its counterparts across the country. So, for example, you know, in a 3-year period between 2000 and 2002 in Los Angeles, the rate was 11%. In New York, it was 9%. In Cook County, Chicago, it was 6%. In Philadelphia, it was 14%. But in Sheriff Joe's prison, it was 24%.
Jesus.
Right? Like, that is not an inconsequential number. And I think that clearly something is happening inside of this space that is causing a hugely disproportionate number of the deaths that take place inside of this prison. One, that there are a lot of deaths that are happening that are not suicides that we should be really concerned about, but that the rate is 24% clearly indicates that something is happening and that the culture of this prison is incredibly violent and incredibly toxic in a way that is sort of representative and emblematic of the way that he ran these prisons generally.
Yeah, I'm struck by that for 20 years, Sheriff Joe operated what was called Tent City, which was essentially a tent of a jail that was made with surplus military equipment. And when he constructed it, he said that it was to save money. But in these in Tent City, the temperature could rise to almost 130 degrees in Arizona. The people were shackled to each other during their time there, and that he made them wear pink underwear and pink sandals. And the reason he said he did it is that he didn't want them to steal the underwear or the sandals or the towels. They were all pink. And the shocking thing is, like, how did this last for 20 years? And that the sheriff is elected, and to the credit of all the activists and organizers down there and people who worked so hard to get him unelected this last time, is that it's a reminder that there's so many offices that go up every election year that you just don't think about, because, like, you don't normally think about a sheriff, or you don't normally think about the clerk of the court, or prosecutors traditionally aren't, like, contested races, really. They're not very public races. But it's a great example how, you know, the sheriff in a lot of cities, like, they determine what happens in the jail, that they are the people who essentially function as the local wardens. And we have to put much more attention to them, because I would say that while he was likely one of the worst in the country, there are probably other people who are also really bad. I think about the sheriff in Milwaukee, who is a nightmare, too, that, like, we need to make sure that we get them out of office.
So this is a great segue to talk about something that's a little bit more uplifting. You know, we talk a lot about systems of oppression that are manifesting themselves in a myriad of ways on this podcast. And that's important. And we want to name and bring attention to those things. But it's also important for us to name the victories, no matter how small they are, that are sort of moving us toward the world that we want to build and the world we want to live in. And last week, we got some good news. The ethnic studies classes that had previously been banned under the Republican legislature in Arizona, a federal judge ruled that that law banning ethnic studies from public schools in Arizona was racist, and that it was clearly intended to remove and target a Mexican-American studies program at Tucson High School, where the minority enrollment at the school was nearly 90%. And, you know, the pretense that the Republican legislators were discussing was that the classes were stoking racial tensions and they were radicalizing students. You know, texts like Pedagogy of the Oppressed and Paulo Freire's famous text, and thinking a lot about issues of oppression in a K-12 context. But the judge has said that that was unlawful and that they couldn't do that. And this is really important. You know, we've talked about ethnic studies a bunch of times on this podcast, so we don't need to go through it again. But it is an incredible thing and an incredible opportunity for a lot of the students in Arizona to have these Mexican-American studies and African-American studies and Asian-American studies classes back. Because as we've talked about, there is one of the most important things that can be done in schools and in classrooms is to teach young people, especially young people who live on the margins, about their history and to use it as a means to sort of rid them of the pathologies that they've been inundated with about who their community members are, who their family is. And with that, the sort of famous phrase, not with knowledge comes power, you know, it can seem cliche, but it it has real empirical weight to that. You know, you can mm-hmm. go through all of the research that shows that students who take ethnic studies courses have higher attendance rates, they have higher graduation rates, they have higher test scores. And so these are, you know, this is not just sort of make Black and brown people feel good. This is like, this has real academic merit to it. And it's something that's just incredibly important for young people to understand and gain a sense of as young as possibly as we possibly can.
I think it is important. I'm glad that you brought that up to celebrate the wins, to give people hope that we actually can. We can win and we will win. You know, it's an important win, not just for, as you said, Clint, young people on the margins, young people of color who need to learn about their history. But quite frankly, if everyone is learning mm-hmm. this kind of diverse history, if Definitely. Everyone is engaging in ethnic studies, if quite frankly, we can get to the point where it's not ethnic studies and it's just history
right.
For everyone, then I think we will all be better off, right? And those are the kinds of things that help dismantle what we saw in Charlottesville, when people learn history that is accurate and not just a history of oppression. Because we're all in the studio together, we've been kind of sending each other messages. DeRay just forwarded us an article that says Sheriff Joe may, now that he is pardoned, now that he is a free man, have mercy, he may decide to challenge the sitting Arizona Senator Jeff Flake in his reelection bid and may try to sit in the U.S. Senate. I really hope that there is no truth to these rumors. I hope that if there is truth, he decides to sit his behind on down. However, this is exactly what we mean when we talk about the emboldening that is happening across this country, because this dude is fresh out of jail from rounding up all the brown folks, all the people he suspected to be illegal immigrants, quote unquote, as he would say.
How brazen.
I mean,
we do have to make, you know, it is one of the ways that oppression works so well is that people forget that they have power, or like the system is designed to make you think that you don't have power.
Yeah.
And that's one of the insidious ways that like there are a lot of people who didn't vote because they're like, well, it doesn't matter what I do. And it's like Arpaio is a great example of like it actually does matter a whole lot what you do. Yeah. And like, granted, we need to deal with like disenfranchisement and that whole piece of the puzzle too. But there are people who have the right to vote who have been convinced that their vote doesn't matter.
There are incredible people, you know, in Arizona who would be incredible senators and probably, you know, as Brittany said, have convinced themselves that they're not qualified. And yet you see this man, Arpaio, who believes he's perfectly qualified. Not only that, but confident enough that he would run and thinks he can win, right? And so, you know, what kind of value system, what kind of ideology empowers and emboldens people like Arpaio and disempowers the incredible people who could run for that seat instead?
It's the news. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
And now my conversation with Reggie Bolden, the only Black legislator in the Arizona State Legislature, 31 years old, a former teacher. Let's go. Hey, Reggie, thanks so much for joining us today. I know that you are in the Arizona State Legislature. How long have you been in the legislature and what's your role?
So this is my third year serving in the state legislature, my second term. I represent downtown Phoenix, South Phoenix, Levine, Arizona, in the state of Arizona. I'm in the House of Representatives, and there I primarily focus on education issues and also issues related to criminal justice reform.
Now, you're in Arizona, and we all across the country just saw, like you did, the pardon of Sheriff Arpaio by Trump. And what is your take on that? What is it like in Arizona? And what is it like to be somebody who is working so hard on issues related to criminal justice and education and to see this pardon happen?
So what we saw with the Department of Arpaio is a major abuse of power, and that's what people feel like here on the ground, who spent literally tens of 10, 15 years really fighting and pushing against Arpaio and his racist procedures. What a lot of people don't realize is that Arpaio, he was convicted. And he was to face a sentencing hearing because he unconstitutionally used race in making traffic stops to find out who was legal and who was not. And that was just something that was found by the judge to be unconstitutional and breaking the law.
And what's the work ahead with regard to the work of criminal justice reform in Arizona?
So there's a number of different things that we're facing here in Arizona. One, you not only have an issue like we see across the country with regards to people of color, African-American men being shot by law enforcement officers. We also have an issue in which we see that people are being racially profiled because they look like they are from, because they have a Latino background. So we have a little bit of both in which that we want to work with the federal government to make sure that there is comprehensive immigration reform, because we do have institutions in place that are targeting the Latino community. And then also at a state and local level, working with our elected leaders to make sure that we are actually creating an environment in which everyone feels safe, no matter who they are or what they look like.
And Sheriff Arpaio was replaced recently, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So Sheriff Joe Arpaio, he for so many years targeted the Latino community. And what you saw in 2016 was that the Latino community that has been racially profiled and targeted was able to build a movement unlike seen before, in which 160,000 new people were registered to vote. You had a number of organizers knocking on doors, galvanizing community members to vote. And for the first time, Sheriff Joe Arpaio was actually defeated from office. And there's a new sheriff in town. His name's Paul Pinzone. So for the community, it was a little bittersweet to see that Sheriff Joe was removed from office in 2016, and then only to have Donald Trump, President Trump, come in and pardon him for one of the major factors of why even Republicans were voting against him during the 2016 election.
And Reggie, you all are working on removing some Confederate statues in Arizona right now, too. Is that correct?
Yes, we are. So right now, in the state of Arizona, what a lot of people don't know is that we actually have six Confederate statues that are on state property. One actually is located right in front of the state capitol. And that Confederate statue in and of itself is one that's commemorating soldiers for essentially everything that they did during the Confederacy. The biggest thing about that statue is that it was put there in the 1960s, right in the middle of the civil rights movement, primarily to be used as a form of hate, to as a form to allow individuals who were African Americans to know that you should not have equal rights. So right now, myself, members of the local NAACP, other community leaders, Arizona Coalition for Change, we are all collectively pushing for our governor to hold a meeting. We need to have something called a legislative mall commission, and this commission will allow us to actually remove that monument. Right now, we've got commitments from the chair to actually hold this conversation so we can remove that. But right now, it appears that our governor, our Speaker of the House, and our Senate President, they are standing in the way of allowing us to remove that monument here at the state capitol. With regards to the other monuments, there's progress being made. We have a Jefferson Davis Memorial Highway, and I've asked for that, the renaming of that highway, back in 2015. And it looks like we're actually going to be coming up to a point where there will be a vote on whether or not we change that name. And that's something I'm looking forward to.
And Reggie, what is it like to be young? You're young, right?
31.
What is it like to be a young Black man in the legislature in Arizona in a context that doesn't always seem friendly to issues about race or justice? What is that like?
you know, it's a balance here that within the state legislature, in which as a young Black man in the state legislature, which a lot of people don't realize that I'm the only African American in the state legislature, House or Senate here in Arizona, is that many times we've always been taught that you have to work harder, you know, be more strategic, be smarter. And I think that's, those are some of the practices that, you know, growing up that I learned that I've had to rely on here. So, walking in, recognizing that I had a background in education and a background in criminal justice, was a way to allow me to sit at the front of the table, primarily because we had members here at the state legislature that didn't have that experience. But for me, this is a whole new ball game in that it's all about relationships down at the state capitol. If you could build solid relationships with people, no matter what background they're in, no matter what their party affiliation, you can get things done. And I've been able to actually do that. A lot of people don't know that Arizona didn't celebrate Juneteenth. I was able to get a bill with Arizona is now Juneteenth is a state holiday in Arizona. Been able to get some early childhood education passed committees as a Democrat in a majority Republican state legislature. And that's primarily because of the relationships that I've been able to build to really talk to people about, you know, where we want to be and not using, you know, my age as a major barrier.
And you were a teacher, right?
Yeah, I was a teacher. I was a teacher. I was a middle school teacher, so 7th and 8th grade.
What subject?
So I was a special education teacher. So I taught math and I taught reading. And it's a little bittersweet because I moved to Arizona about 10 years ago from Ohio. I was on my way to law school and decided that I wanted to be a teacher and really give back to my community, recognizing that there weren't a lot of African-American men in a classroom. In fact, I'd never had an African-American teacher in my life prior to jumping into the classroom. And it's a little bittersweet being here now representing the district that I moved to Arizona to teach in. Primarily because, again, we've seen a lot of complacency. It wasn't okay that our kids had to walk to school in the streets because there weren't no sidewalks, or we didn't have textbooks, so we had to Xerox copy our workbooks for kids. So that just didn't seem like that should be where our kids, that shouldn't be an education our kids had to have. So that really kind of inspired me to run, and my teaching experience is all wrapped up into just, you know, what I'm fighting for every day.
And Reggie, where can people go to learn more information about you or the work that's happening with regard to making Arizona a more just and equitable place?
Yeah, so there is an organization right now here in Arizona that's really at the front line that's pushing for criminal justice reform, education reform, safer communities, and that's the Arizona Coalition for Change. So if you are in Arizona, you come into Arizona, if you want to get involved, I encourage you to go to AZC4C.org. So that's AZC4C.org, Arizona Coalition for Change. I'm the board chair there, and the work that we're doing is directly impacting our communities every day. We're part of a larger organization called One Arizona, and we'll be registering over 200,000 people to vote during 2018. We'll be really reaching into communities that haven't been reached into before and really using, you know, civic engagement as a way to change policy and practice so we can get a community that's responsive to the needs of everybody.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today on this episode of Pod Save the People. We consider you a friend of the pod, and please keep us posted on what's happening in Arizona.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out. Make sure to rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we'll see you next week.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware. Shop chef quality pots and pans at madeincookware.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze,
relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.